30-year-old Paige Rynkowski woke up on May 24, 1990 to drive her mother to the airport. After dropping her off, she began making the 90-mile trip home, stopping off to visit a friend along the way. Everything about her normal day, though, stopped after she got back on the interstate. In the afternoon, several hours after leaving the airport, Paige was spotted outside of her car on the shoulder of I-96. Witnesses reported seeing at least one, but possibly up to three men on the side of the road and a minivan parked behind her car. Reportedly, at least one of these men was talking with Paige and may have pulled her towards the minivan. Police came upon a bizarre scene. Paige's car was idling on the side of the road with headlights and radio still on. Paige's purse and shoes were left behind in the car, but Paige herself was gone. For 30 years, her case has been the subject of investigations, renewed investigations, and now cold case investigations. Multiple disappearances in the same area have sparked interest. Numerous tips have suggested a possible burial location. But after everything, the truth of what happened to Paige Rynkowski is as haunting today as it was 30 years ago. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 110, The Vanishing of Paige Rynkowski. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the vanishing of Paige Rynkowski, truly one of the most baffling and mysterious cases I've ever covered. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders, disappearances, and other crimes. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show, as it is a one-man operation, and you'd like to get some Trace Evidence swag, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information, as well as thorough information on all episodes. To submit case suggestions, you can visit the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Paige Rynkowski dropped her mother at the airport, visited a friend, and then vanished, leaving behind only a bizarre series of clues that, to this day, haunt investigators and her family. This is episode 110, The Vanishing of Paige Rynkowski. Born on February 2nd, 1960, 30-year-old Paige Rynkowski had made plans to pick up her mother, Artis, and give her a ride to the Detroit Metro Airport. Paige was extremely close with her mother, the type of woman who was always there for her and made sure she knew how much she was loved. Throughout her youth and well into adulthood, Paige was always doing sweet things to express her affection for the family matriarch. News articles and interviews are flooded with stories recounting her sweet and caring behaviors. From making cupcakes to writing Valentine's Day notes, there wasn't a day that went by that Paige wasn't lighting up someone's life. In the years after Paige's strange and haunting disappearance, her mother would treasure those memories and cling to those notes, photographs, and gifts, the last remnants of a daughter who seemingly vanished from the face of the earth. In the Lansing State Journal, Artis told the heartwarming story of how Paige, the eldest of four daughters, once left her retreat in the freezer with a note attached explaining that she had done so simply because she loved her so much. The descriptions of Paige span the gamut of love and tenderness, with many describing her as the type of person who could take even the most difficult and challenging day and find a reason to smile. In the aforementioned article, Artis explains how her daughter always, quote, had a smile, even when things weren't going the way she would like them to, end quote. Things had not often gone the way Paige had wanted. Her mother had divorced her father, Carl, and it had hardly been an amicable separation. There had been financial hardships and career challenges, particularly in the years after her graduation from high school, where she wasn't exactly sure what she wanted to do. In a tribute post, A childhood friend of Paige's described her post-high school life as drifting, as so many of us do when confronted by the choices that need to be made to carve out a future. In that same post, Paige's friend described a restaurant grease fire which resulted in the young woman being burned, and while the recovery was painful, Paige maintained her optimistic outlook and joyful personality. She seemed, by all descriptions, to be the type of person who never cashed out, even when the chips were down. Paige had a charismatic personality and a desire to entertain others, even while entertaining herself. She earned the title of Drama Queen of the Basement Productions, referencing the hours she had spent in childhood putting on plays in the family basement. Next to Paige's captivating personality and loving disposition, she was also very attractive, having done time as a model for a now-defunct Michigan-based department store. She was a cheerleader in high school and was also heavily involved in a singing group. According to Livingston Daily, Paige was also a dancer who performed in shows sponsored by 17 Magazine. Indeed, Paige was a woman of many parts, with the Tribune Post explaining, at great length, how she had gone out of her way to invite a new student at school into her circle of friends, one which was always expanding. The author would explain how Paige never met a stranger because she had such a warm and welcoming way about her, she would always make a new friend. From everything I've read about Paige, one repeating description is fun. Paige was fun to be around and took joy in making others laugh. Paige's sister, Michelle, told Dateline in 1990 that beyond her sense of humor, kindness, and care, Paige was a hardworking woman with a desire to educate, working at the time as a substitute preschool aide while she pursued her degree in early childhood development. She'd always loved children and had actually spent a lot of her time in her youth as a babysitter. Linda Remington fondly remembered Paige as having babysat her kids multiple times, telling the Lansing State Journal, quote, "Paige was a sweetheart who lectured my kids about not getting into cars with strangers. She was like my kid, their sister," end quote. At the time of her disappearance, Paige's sister was living in Atlanta, and when her mother made plans to visit, Paige volunteered to drive her to the airport. The Okemos native was living in DeWitt, a suburb of Lansing at the time, approximately 90 miles to the east. The drive would predominantly have been done along Interstate 96, running southeast from Lansing to Detroit. It was a typical drive, not too long, and passing through Brighton, Howell, and Fowlerville along the way. Being that she was going to be heading out that morning anyway, Paige made plans to stop and visit a friend in Canton, some 15 miles northwest of the airport. It was set to be a normal day, a stop along the way and a return home. In several articles, friends and family described Paige as a homebody. She liked traveling, liked when she visited her sister in Atlanta, but she was always eager to get home. The comfort of her own home was something she often sought, her own sanctuary of calm and comfort. Even with her drive that morning, Paige was looking forward to attending her fiancé's softball game that afternoon and then getting home, but no one could have imagined that the 30-year-old would mysteriously vanish, with her case becoming one of the coldest in Michigan's history, a case which remains as mystifying today as it was that day in late May of 1990. Paige had recently found love, the kind of love that she wanted to last a lifetime. Throughout much of her teens and 20s, she had been pursued by a number of potential suitors, and while some relationships had been better than others, no one had yet found a way to capture her wild and independent spirit. No one until Steve DeBrabender. Paige graduated high school in 1978, and 9 years later, while attending a hockey game at Michigan State University, she met Steve and everything was different. Shortly thereafter, she told her family that Steve was the one, and over the next 3 years, they moved in together and became engaged. Their wedding was planned for November, some 6 months after she would vanish. The relationship wasn't always perfect, what relationship ever is, but it's been said in several articles and posts that when the two argued, it was passionate and it was loud. Despite some bumps in the road, at the center of their union was love, with Paige and Steve determined to make it work. In the months after her disappearance, Steve would come under scrutiny, with some wondering if he may have played a role, a suspicion that remains to this day for some. However, he had a solid alibi, and while for some that's enough, others have wondered if he could have been the mind behind the orchestration of her disappearance rather than the one who actually performed it. On the morning of Thursday, May 24th, everything was still going to plan. Sometime between 11 and 11:30 a.m., Paige was arriving at the airport to drop off her mother. There were hugs and exchanges of I love yous and a promise of time together when she returned. Paige hopped back into her mother's silver 1986 Oldsmobile Cutlass and traveled through the airport loop, taking several turns and then getting onto I-96 westbound. Paige pulled off in Canton. She and her friend met up, and then she went to nearby Griffith Park with her. Paige's friend, someone she had known since high school, had children, and so the two were meant to hang out for a while in the fresh air, catching up, and Paige doted on the child, as was her typical behavior. While this is not the last official sighting of Paige, it is the last sighting by someone who actually knew her. The name of Paige's friend has never been released publicly, but according to all discussion about this case, there didn't seem to be anything off about the meeting. As far as has been explained by investigators and family, it was a nice meeting which lasted an hour at most before Paige got back onto I-96 to finish the final hour of her drive. This is where the story begins to take a turn into the inexplicable, or at least in a direction which most people can understand. At approximately 2:30 p.m., some 3 hours after dropping her mother off, and 15 to 20 minutes after visiting her friend, Paige made a stop at a store on Ford Road, west of Interstate 275, which runs north to south and intersects I-96 in the area of Plymouth, approximately 4 miles to the east of Canton. It's believed that Paige may have been traveling north to get back to I-96, where she would continue her drive home. At the store, Paige purchased a single bottle of beer, which was wrapped in a brown paper bag, and a magazine. The clerk working in the store, believed to have been a gas station convenience store, remembered Paige clearly due to her clothing. Several articles explain that the clerk remembered seeing her being dressed in, quote, distinctive, multicolored, loose-fitting, flower-patterned pants and distinctive necklace, end quote. Several photos of Paige wearing this outfit are available and, of course, will be posted on the website. After leaving the store, Paige continued her westward travel, getting back on I-96. Several long-haul truck drivers later reported passing Paige's car heading west, according to the Lansing State Journal. However, yet another bizarre turn of events will occur, which, to this day, leaves both her family and investigators baffled and wondering. Sometime between 3:15 and 3:30, Paige pulled her car over to the side of the westbound lane of I-96 for reasons unknown. The location of her stop was between Howell and Fowlerville, not far from the Fowlerville exit near mile marker 129. This would place Paige approximately 36 miles to the southeast of DeWitt, more than halfway through her drive home. Over the course of the next hour or so, multiple passersby noticed Paige on the side of the road. Several of these witnesses described a blonde woman dressed in the previously mentioned clothing standing outside of her car. However, many witnesses also reported seeing a maroon or burgundy minivan parked not far from her car. Reportedly, at least one African-American male was present and talking to Paige, though others have reported two men outside of the van and possibly a third inside. Approximately 80% of the witnesses reported a black male, while 20% said it could have been a Hispanic male. While some witnesses reported seeing the van parked in front of Paige's car, the majority of witnesses place it behind the car and stated that Paige and the unidentified man or men were standing between the two vehicles talking. Some witnesses also reported seeing other vehicles, a white truck, a blue truck, a red cargo van, but again, the majority reported a burgundy or maroon minivan, and authorities believe the other sightings were simply witnesses confusing broken-down vehicles. At least one witness reported seeing Paige driving at a high rate of speed prior to mile marker 129, while another vehicle appeared to be in pursuit, though this sighting has never been verified. Some witnesses stated that they saw Paige talking with the man before throwing her hands up in the air. Allegedly, the man then reached out and placed a hand on her shoulder. Other witnesses, though, reported seeing Paige throwing her hands up in the air, followed by one of the men grabbing her elbow, pulling her back towards the minivan. One particular witness reported seeing Paige speaking with the male around 4 p.m. 3.5 hours later, at approximately 7:30 p.m., the same witness passed by the area again, and this time noticed that Paige's car was on the side of the road, but the minivan was gone, and there was no sign of Paige. Thinking the situation was weird, the witness called into the police. Being that the vehicle was in Livingston County, a sheriff's deputy was sent to check out the car and determine what was going on. No one's been able to determine why Paige pulled over that day, and you may be thinking what I was. Maybe she experienced car trouble and pulled over hoping to flag someone down for assistance. While certainly a logical thought, nothing is logical in this case, as when the deputy arrived on the scene, he found a bizarre situation. The driver's side door was unlocked, the keys were in the ignition, the headlights and radio were both on, and the car was idling, suggested that it had been running for several hours on the side of the road. The vehicle was completely drivable. There didn't appear to be anything wrong with it, and there was no damage to the car to suggest an accident, though a later report says there was minor damage to the front end, but nothing that would suggest a collision. The magazine Paige had purchased was on the passenger seat. The bottle of beer she purchased was inside the paper bag lying on the floorboard on the passenger side. The beer had been opened, and at least some of it had been drank, with reports noting that it was an open container, but no reports labeling it as empty. In addition to the beer and the magazine, there were items in the car which should have set off alarm bells for the deputy. Firstly, Paige's purse was found in the car with her wallet inside. There was money in the wallet and what has been described as personal papers. Running the car's information determined that it belonged to Paige's mother, and so the deputy left a message on Artis's answering machine, though she was in Atlanta and wouldn't get it for several days. Lastly, and perhaps most bizarrely, the shoes Paige had been wearing that day were sitting on the floorboard of the driver's side, one shoe facing towards the interior, the other facing the door. The shoes were sitting neatly side by side. However, we can't be sure this is how the shoes, the beer, the magazine, or anything else in the car was positioned, because despite the vehicle being found running, despite the items inside, despite the call that the car had been sitting there for hours, the deputy didn't call it in. He didn't process the car as a crime scene. Instead, he determined that the vehicle was abandoned and that the driver had likely walked the quarter of a mile west to the Fowlerville exit to call for assistance. Because of how often people abandon cars on the side of the road with the keys still in them and the engine running. So, instead of processing the scene, he tagged the car and had it towed. This means that however the vehicle appeared upon finding it, things could have shifted around and may not have been left as later photos would determine. As far as I can tell, they went off the deputy's description, but how accurate or inaccurate that was, I don't know. Even the exact location of the car is somewhat debated, as since the car was towed, there was no notation of the exact location of where it was found. It is known that it was found between Howell and Fowlerville, being closer to the latter, but the exact location is, at best, an estimate. Mike Freyer, a member of the Livingston County Sheriff's Department cold case team, later told the Lansing State Journal, quote, "We've got a general idea of where the exact scene was, but we're not exactly sure. They didn't photograph the scene or do a crime scene sketch because, at the time, it was an abandoned car, and that is how they treated it. It wasn't until later that they knew what they had." End quote. How it was determined that the car was connected to a now missing person has never been made clear, at least not in any of my research. But we do know that the investigators went back to the car and began processing it for evidence while trying to gather statements from witnesses. In the vehicle, there didn't appear to be any signs of a struggle, there was no blood, but it's been reported that they recovered several finger and palm prints, which have, to this day, gone unidentified. When the family became aware, Paige's mother and sister flew up from Atlanta to get information and help with searching. Flyers were put together rapidly and plastered all over town. The family answered a ton of calls with tips from witnesses. Most of the accounts were similar to the ones I conveyed earlier. Police, in their effort to try and track down Paige, brought 9 tracking dogs into the area where the car was found and also brought them into a 500-acre wooded area nearby, but no scent or trace of Paige was picked up. A helicopter was also used to search from above. Investigators and the family were left with several questions which have never been answered. Why did Paige park on the side of the road that day? Did someone flag her down? Did someone flash a badge? Did she see someone who appeared to need assistance? Why would she take her shoes off to walk along the dirty, gravelly, painful shoulder of the road? For their part, Paige's family have been emphatic that she would not have stopped for a stranger on the side of the road, and she also wouldn't have run off. Subsequent investigation found that, prior to her disappearance, Paige had deposited money into her bank account. While the exact amount has never been specified, multiple articles have referred to it as a large sum of money. However, it's interesting to note that since her disappearance, there has been no activity on the account, which seems to do only more to throw water onto the possibility of the 30-year-old having chosen to leave of her own volition. A month after Paige's disappearance, 25 billboards were erected along I-96 hoping to generate tips. 14 Sheriff's Department investigators and investigators from the FBI were working in conjunction to try and find Paige. Tips poured in for the case, receiving more than 60 in the first week and over 1,000 over time. Many of them told the same story as others. Some were mere sightings. There were, though, multiple composite sketches composed over the years and shown to witnesses with various responses about their accuracy. One particular witness, a former police officer, gave a detailed description of a man he says he saw looking into the back window of Paige's car that day. For the most part, no tips led to anything concrete. Approximately 6 months after Paige vanished, the story took another unusual turn. A letter was delivered to the sheriff's department, specifically addressed to the investigators working on Paige's case. Well, there's some debate about how the letter arrived, with stories of the time saying it was mysteriously left on an investigator's desk, while more recent interviews have claimed it arrived in a plain envelope with no return address. Either way, included in the envelope was a fairly detailed map which allegedly pointed out a location in which Paige's body was buried. Investigators went to the area, a property off Sober Road in Conway Township, approximately 10 miles north of where Paige was last seen. Despite searchers using tracking dogs and the utilization of ground-penetrating radar, no trace of Paige was found. According to later investigators, however, it was believed that the initial search may have been conducted in the wrong location. Strangely, the details about the map itself wouldn't become public knowledge until 8 years later in 1999. Even Paige's family were unaware of its existence, which caused some animosity between the family and the original investigators. In what I can only call a bizarre set of coincidences or the blatant possibility of a connection, 6 other women vanished from within 25 miles of where Paige was last seen, within a 2-year stretch of her own disappearance. 2 other women disappeared within 100 miles. 8 days after Paige vanished on June 1, 1990, 24-year-old Connie Lynn Bostick Royce disappeared after leaving a bar in Mount Clemens, some 72 miles east of where Paige's car was found. Royce has never been found. 3 months later, on September 11th, 46-year-old Cheryl Louise Garner disappeared from her home in Detroit, some 60 miles to the southeast of Paige's disappearance. She's never been found either. 1 year and 4 months after Paige's disappearance, 18-year-old Camille Villanueva disappeared from Pontiac Trail in South Lyon, some 30 miles to the southeast. 2 weeks later, on September 29th, sisters Michelle and Melissa Urban, 16 and 14 respectively, vanished from Tyrone Township near Fenton, some 27 miles to the northeast of Paige. 4 months later, on January 4, 1992, 16-year-old Cynthia Marie Jones disappeared from Central Park, Milford, some 32 miles to the east of Paige. 4 of these cases were eventually solved. 40-year-old Leslie Allen Williams was arrested and later confessed to the rape and murders of Cami Villanueva, Cynthia Marie Jones, and Melissa and Michelle Urban. Williams was also considered a suspect in the disappearance of Connie Royce, though no solid link has ever been established. Investigators, though, believe there's a strong chance that Williams did commit that crime. This leaves only Cheryl Garner and Paige Renkoski as the two disappearances for which there are no answers. It's interesting to note, though, that all of Williams' murders that are confirmed took place in the 60 miles between Garner and Renkoski's disappearances. We know, according to investigators, that Williams could not have been responsible for Paige's disappearance as he was incarcerated at the time. However, if you thought this was bizarre already, here's where things get even more surreal. A 45-year-old man, who's never been officially identified, shared a cell with Williams when both were incarcerated at Muskegon Correctional Facility. The unidentified inmate was, at the time, serving 3 life sentences for 3 separate abductions and sexual assaults. Now, you may be thinking this man had something interesting to tell about his former cellmate, Williams, but on the contrary, the unnamed felon himself was actually considered a suspect in Page's disappearance. It's a bit overwhelming, I know, but to sum it up, Williams abducted, raped, and murdered 4 women who vanished within 60 miles of Page. His former cellmate, a convicted rapist himself, was then considered a suspect in Page's disappearance. What are the odds of that happening? It has to be astronomical. When speaking to the Lansing State Journal, Detective Edwin Moore stated, quote, "We have no definitive proof he was involved. It's just like any other tip. If we have a name that's given to us, we look into their background to see if they were in a position to have done this crime." End quote. Here, it gets a little more confusing. There's another inmate who police question in regard to Page's disappearance who seems to be different from Williams' cellmate. This inmate had been involved in a carjacking of a young woman just a few weeks after Page disappeared. This individual was questioned on multiple occasions and eventually given a polygraph test, which he passed. He was eventually ruled out as a suspect. While I'd like to give you more information, the police elected not to name this person either. Moving on, there are some weird airport connections. Cheryl Sanders, 29, was found shot to death in rural Van Buren Township, some 54 miles to the southeast of where Page disappeared, in April of 1992. Cheryl had disappeared from the airport Holiday Inn. Then there's Nancy Ludwig, a Northwest flight attendant who was raped and killed at the airport Hilton. Nancy's killer would ultimately be found through DNA testing and confirmed to be Jeffrey Gorton. He was also found guilty in raping and murdering a professor in 1986. So why the tie-in? Because Paige had been to that airport the day she vanished. It is worth noting, though, that as far as the named killers go, they've all been white, which would seem to rule them out of Paige's disappearance unless the African-American or possibly Hispanic man or men seen with Paige that day are not responsible for her disappearance. I can't know the ethnicities of the 2 inmates as they were never publicly named. There's also the case of 30-year-old Beverly Wivel. Wivel was murdered in the fall of 1989, just a few months before Paige's disappearance. The interesting link between the 2 cases here is that when Wivel's vehicle was found, it was found abandoned at Griffith Park, the same park Paige would go to with her friend just months later, the second to last stop she made before vanishing. Unfortunately, information in regard to Wivel is fairly limited, and I've been unable to determine whether or not her homicide was ever solved. The last article in which she's mentioned was released in 2001, and I couldn't find any updates. This does lead some to wonder if there could have been someone using the park itself as a hunting ground. Beverly is buried at Highland Cemetery in Ypsilanti. Perhaps most sad is the fact that Beverly was on her way to pick up her son at the time of her murder, leaving the young boy waiting and wondering where his mother might be. For the most part, Paige's case has grown hot and cold over the years. Within months of her 1990 disappearance, tips began drying up and leads failed to develop. In the late 1990s, her case was reopened and investigated while new tips came in and new composite images were developed, but no new leads were sustained. In 2011, a new investigation into Page's disappearance resulted in a new review of the map which had been sent to investigators in 1991. After reinterpreting the map, on November 18th, a joint team of local police, FBI, and Michigan State University experts began digging in Conway Township, some 6 miles to the north of where Page vanished. This appears to be the location originally examined near Sober Road back in 1990 and 91. According to CBS 62 Detroit, excavation began at approximately 8:30 a.m. The previous week, cadaver dogs were brought in and hit on two areas at that site. Previously, only tracking dogs had been used. Unfortunately, just as the previous search had ended, nothing was found connected to Page at that site. In 2015, around the 25-year mark since Page had vanished, cold case investigators went back into the case, but no new information was developed. By this time, Page's case had been ruled to have been a homicide, no longer a missing persons case, and while information was fading, the investigators were still determined to crack it. It became a matter of asking the public for assistance, with Mike Freyer telling the Lansing State Journal, quote, "We believe there's someone out there who does know. It's time for them to do the right thing, and it's time to come forth and tell us what they know. This family and this young lady deserve justice." End quote. Sadly, in December of 2017, Page's mother, Artis, passed away at the age of 84. She had spent the last 27 years of her life trying to find her daughter, but she refused to allow the disappearance to destroy her life. Instead, she became an advocate for the families of missing persons and operated as a liaison between the families and law enforcement. Her hard work and determination in the face of such adversity was admirable, and many in the community respected and spoke well of her. Law enforcement credited Artis as instrumental in creating Missing in Michigan, which holds a memorial every May in honor of missing persons. In a 2011 interview, Artis stated, quote, "I made a decision a long time ago that this would not destroy me. I decided I would be no good to my family or anyone if I let it destroy me. I've turned it into a path for advocacy, and I'm not focused on what someone did to my beautiful daughter." End quote. A dual memorial was held for Artis and Page on February 2, 2018, what would have been Page's 58th birthday. The family acknowledged that they had never had a memorial for Paige, other than getting together on her birthday every year to remember her. While they continue their advocacy and fight to find out what happened to Paige and where she is, they found comfort in believing that Paige and Artis may now be reunited. Paige Marie Renkoski was last seen on May 24, 1990, along I-96 near Fowlerville, Michigan. At the time of her disappearance, Page was described as being a white female with blonde hair and blue eyes, standing 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing approximately 125 pounds. Page has surgical scars on her right arm and right leg. She also has a scar on her right elbow. Page has 2 surgical screws in her left knee, and her right knee has been replaced. When last seen, Page was wearing a white silk blouse, baggy silk pants with multicolored flower patterns, and a long beaded necklace. If alive today, Paige would have turned 60 years old 2 months ago, on February 2nd. 30 years have passed. Paige Renkoski has never been forgotten, and for her family, it's vital and important to keep her name alive. In a 2019 interview, Paige's sister Michelle expressed the family's dedicated efforts to continue her mother's work in fighting for Paige. In a 2019 interview with NBC, Michelle expressed their hope that new technologies and the advancement of DNA will one day crack the case open. In regard to searching for Paige, she stated, quote, "We will never stop looking, stop going back, or having the cold case team go back and look over things that they've already done years ago." Did you know that up to 80% of the immune system is influenced by the gut? or that supporting the immune system through proper diet and digestive health enables pets to better fight environmental allergies? Solid Gold is passionate about gut health because a healthy digestive system positively impacts the immune system and overall wellness of pets. Solid Gold's nutritional platform is inspired by their founding belief that high-quality food is the best way to impact our pet's mind, body, and spirit. For over 45 years, Solid Gold has revolutionized the holistic pet food category, and they have a recipe for any dog or cat's dietary needs, including healthy, whole grain and grain-free options, wet food, supplements like sea meal, and 100% human-grade bone broth for dogs. Right now, to see the Solid Gold deal of the week, go to solidgoldpet.com/trace. We all love our pets, and we want them to be healthy and satisfied. My dog loves Solid Gold. She gets the great taste while I get the relief of knowing she's well taken care of. That's solidgoldpet.com/trace to see the deal of the week. Remember, solidgoldpet.com/trace. There's a lot of products out there that claim to promote wellness. Drastic diets, extreme fitness routines, over-the-top supplement regimens. We've all tried something at some point and asked, why does taking care of yourself need to be so hard? That's what's great about CBD. It helps you feel better without making drastic changes to your routine. Thankfully, there's Caliper. Caliper is based on the standard that everyone deserves to feel better naturally and that drastic changes shouldn't be required. They've made a more precise and reliable CBD product that's so much easier to use than those CBD oils, but with all the benefits. In the mornings, I add Caliper to my coffee and I can't even taste it. I love Caliper because it's tasteless, easy to use, and dissolves quickly whether it's in liquid or food. Since I started taking Caliper, I fall asleep easier and my stress level has fallen noticeably. My joints and body feel less achy, and overall, I just feel calmer. Caliper CBD comes in affordable 10 and 30 count packs, and you can get started for under $20. Individual 20 milligram packets give you the maximum benefits of CBD wherever you go without the stigma of using one of those weird droppers. Unlike some products out there, Caliper is completely THC free. All of the benefits of CBD without the high, and it's made of all natural, non-GMO ingredients. No fillers or added chemicals here. Through Trace Evidence, you can get 20% off your first order when you use the promo code TRACE at trycaliper.com/trace. Caliper is so sure you'll love the product, they even offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's trycaliper.com/trace. Don't forget promo code TRACE for 20% off your first order today. Paige Rynkowski's disappearance is a very strange and very sad case. It's always disturbing when someone seemingly disappears into thin air, more so when you're left with a series of strange clues at the scene, and even more so when it happens in broad daylight along the side of an interstate that has a large amount of traffic going by. There were witnesses, composites, potential suspects, and a bizarre map that's never been fully understood. There's palm prints, fingerprints, and thousands of tips. So why is it that 30 years later, the truth of what became of Paige still remains unknown? Before hopping into the theories, I did want to address something quickly, and that's the bizarre map that was delivered to the police approximately 6 months after Paige disappeared. Firstly, I don't know the veracity of that map. It could be legitimate. It could be completely made up. I've read that it was very detailed. I've read that it was vague. From what I can tell, the map has never been shared publicly, and there have been multiple searches in that area with no results. It is intriguing that cadaver dogs hit on two locations, though when digging began, nothing was found. That could suggest a murder took place there, but the body was taken somewhere else. But they could also be false positives. Now, differing factors can play a role in the success of a cadaver dog, but multiple tests have proven they can detect the scent of decomposition for many years. In one test, cadaver dogs detected a human bone buried 12 inches deep that had been there for 30 years. Those hits are intriguing, but unfortunately, there's just nowhere to go with them. Do you think the map is legitimate or simply being read wrong, or do you think the whole thing was a cruel joke? Honestly, I'm torn on it. When it comes to theories in this case, it's almost everything and nothing. Was it someone Paige knew who managed to lure her into a trap? Did someone with evil intentions pull up behind her on the shoulder of I-96 when he or they saw a vulnerable woman? Was Paige supposed to be meeting someone in that location and things turned bad? Was Paige pursued or waved down by someone who was looking to abduct the young woman, or maybe any woman that might have been driving by? All of these questions have been asked over the years, and none of them has been met with a sufficient answer. So, let's begin with the things about the scene that have baffled me since I first heard about this case. When Paige's car was found by the Livingston County Sheriff's deputy, who, for reasons I can't fathom, decided it was just a case of an abandoned car, there was nothing about it that made sense. The car had been sitting there for at least 3.5 to 4 hours. The headlights were on, engine running, radio playing. Inside were Paige's shoes, an open container of beer, her purse, the magazine she'd purchased, and other personal effects. I guess to start, the most obvious question is, why the hell were Paige's shoes in the car? Now, I know some people take their shoes off to drive, or they do so while they're driving, but this wasn't a matter of someone just removing their shoes. She stepped out of the car. She was seen talking to someone behind her car. How many of you would be willing to walk barefoot along the side of a busy interstate where there's dirt, gravel, and maybe even glass? Next, I would question, why did Paige stop in that specific location? She was a quarter mile from an exit which would have taken her into Fowlerville. Surely, if she was looking to stretch her legs or take a break, it would have made more sense to just take that exit and find a service station or other location. I mean, no, there was nothing wrong with her car, at least we believe so. When it was found, it was fully operational, though that doesn't necessarily mean it was always operational. Maybe she overheated, maybe she felt there was something wrong. Then again, usually if you think there's something wrong with your car, you don't keep it running with the headlights on. Also, why were the headlights on in the middle of the afternoon? Even still, if she did believe something was wrong with her car, why not continue on to the Fowlerville exit, which was in plain view from the spot she stopped on the side of the road? I suppose the location on the side of the road and the sightings of the minivan raise another series of questions. Did Paige pull up when she saw the minivan on the side of the road to offer assistance? Did the minivan pull up behind her after she'd already pulled over? Is it possible she flagged someone down and it went bad? Is it possible someone flagged her down as a way to trick her? These questions only seem to open the door to more and more questions. One that I've always been wondering about is the beer. You're driving home. You got about 45 minutes to an hour left on your drive. Why do you stop and pick up a beer? Now, I haven't read anything to suggest that Paige had any kind of a substance abuse problem, so I'm not really sure what was going on. If she were picking up the beer for home, surely she could have done that closer to where she lived or even in her town. If she was getting it to drink, it doesn't seem likely that she just decided on a whim to have a drink while driving. I mean, sure, it's possible, but does that really make sense? Why not just get home and then have a drink if you want one? We know Paige's relationship at the time was a bit rocky, so maybe she needed to blow off some steam, but still it would make more sense to me to take the exit and then have your drink if that's what you feel like doing. I don't know what time her fiancé's softball game was that day, but assuming it involved people who had jobs, it probably wouldn't have been until after 5, which would have left Paige with plenty of time to get home, shower, change, and probably throw back a few beers if that's what she wanted to do. To me, the beer is one of the more mysterious aspects of this case, after her shoes. There's been some debate over the years about Paige's fiancé and whether or not he could have been involved in her disappearance. While I understand that thought process, police questioned him at the beginning of the investigation and found nothing to suggest he was involved. Some have argued that he didn't necessarily have to be involved firsthand, but could have hired someone to make Paige disappear. Sure, that's a possibility, but think about it for a moment. You want to make your fiancé disappear. Wouldn't you just give someone her address, tell them where she worked, make it easy? What did he do? Tell them, oh, she'll be driving down I-96 and there's a chance she might stop on the side of the road? Would they have had to have followed her from her mother's house to the airport to Canton to the convenience store onto I-96 and then tried to grab her in broad daylight in view of hundreds of passing cars? That just doesn't make sense to me. Also, that seems like a lot of work to go through to abduct someone when you could have just waited outside of their house. Obviously, she was going to be returning at some point, so why not just stake the place out? Why not grab her at the convenience store or when she went to leave Griffith Park? I just can't seem to make any sense, and I don't think the police agreed with any of this either. There's several reasons why police felt pretty confident that Steve wasn't involved. Firstly, he had a solid alibi. Secondly, he spent months after Paige's disappearance trying to do everything he could to find her. He went so far as to sit on the side of the road where her car was found, making notes of every maroon and burgundy minivan that went by, taking down their license plates and passing them on to investigators in hopes of finding the one that might match the description given by witnesses. While I agree that the significant other is always the rational first place to start, it just doesn't seem to match up in this case. That only leaves us with a few options, several of which have been considered by investigators. Firstly, there's the possibility that Paige knew the man or men who abducted her, and they either got her to pull over, saw her pulled over, or arranged to meet her at that location. The meeting aspect doesn't make a lot of sense to me. If you're planning to abduct her, why not meet in a less public location? It would have been easier to arrange a meeting in a park, maybe at a gas station, in some random place where fewer people are likely to witness. No one in Paige's life recognized the composites or the descriptions of the men that anyone had seen near her. That doesn't mean that they couldn't have known her, just that no one in her life knew them. However, this seems a little less likely, as if Paige knew these people, there'd be some connection to make. Someone would recognize them, someone would have had knowledge, or they'd be around in the area still in that same maroon or burgundy minivan. It's not exactly an inconspicuous vehicle. We know that one witness reported Paige speeding with a vehicle in pursuit, though there's never been any details or proof that this really happened. While this is certainly possible, it seems bizarre that Paige would have been trying to evade someone and then just decided to pull over on the side of the road. Now, maybe Paige made that decision against all logic and reason, but wouldn't it have made more sense to take the Fowlerville exit and go somewhere more public? Seems like the safer option, but instead, we have a shoeless woman walking on the shoulder of the interstate talking to an unknown individual or individuals. Now, if it wasn't someone she knew, then it would have to be someone she didn't know, right? Why was Paige on the side of the road that day may forever remain a mystery. I don't think we're ever going to fully understand anything about it, and all I could do is speculate. Maybe she had a bit of that beer and was feeling it and decided to pull over. Maybe she pulled over specifically to have some of the beer. Maybe she just wanted to stop and look around for some reason. Either way, you've got a woman barefoot on the side of the road, and I don't know about you, but I can't wrap my head around this. I'd love to know what you think, though. So, there's two scenarios here. Was Paige already pulled over on the side of the road when the minivan arrived, or did she pull onto the side of the road when she saw the minivan? While we have no way of knowing the sequence in which these things happened, the former seems to make more sense. If Paige were pulling over because of the minivan, maybe believing they needed assistance or after being flagged down, what is the likelihood she'd have taken her shoes off, or not put them on, before stepping out of the car? We've got several sightings of a man or several men speaking with Paige. We have at least one account of a man grabbing Paige either on the shoulder or the elbow and moving her in the direction of the minivan. That certainly sounds like an abduction in progress, but there was no reaction, no fight, no scream. Maybe they had a weapon on her and told her to behave, but had she reacted when a passing driver was going by, they probably would have noticed. To me, the guys in the van are the most likely people who could be responsible for her disappearance. Beyond that, we've got a couple of serial killers, carjackers, rapists operating in the area. Leslie Allen Williams seemed like a good fit, but he was in prison when Paige disappeared, so that basically rules him out. You've got Jeffrey Gorton, who was later convicted of the murders of Nancy Ludwig and Margaret Ebbe. He was ultimately caught because of DNA evidence. Now, with Paige, she's never been found. You really can't fully rule him out. But maybe you can. We know investigators found finger and palm prints in the car. We don't know for sure that they belong to her abductor or abductors, but if they do, they'd have gotten a match on Gorton. Plus, he didn't seem generally concerned about disposing of his victims' bodies. He basically just left them where he killed them. It's interesting, though, that his first crime was 1986 and his last known crime was 1991. So, if we move back to the guys in the minivan, two inmates have been questioned about this. Well, at least two, but two who have ever been spoken about. We don't know either of their names, ethnicities, or backgrounds, but we do know one was a carjacker and the other was a three-time abductor and rapist. One of these suspects was interviewed by police, polygraphed, and he passed, and then he was ruled out. I truly hope ruling him out was based on more than a polygraph. According to several articles, the other inmate, the carjacker, was given a polygraph and failed, but nothing ever developed from that. I don't put much faith into polygraphs as it is, but if he generally fit any of the descriptions, you'd imagine police would have dug deep into him. It's highly unlikely the guy wouldn't have been willing to trade information about the accomplices for a lesser sentence, assuming there were other accomplices. Remember, witness statements conflict about how many assailants there were. There's also fingerprints and palm prints, but if they belong to one of the other three, then you're not guaranteed a match. Either way, everything seems to track back to the minivan, and it's really the best clue in the whole case. One to three men park behind Paige in the hour before she's believed to disappear. At least one man speaking to her behind her car, but in front of the minivan. The possible scenarios are endless, whether it's a plotted abduction, a pursuit, someone stopping to help out who has bad intentions. If her car wasn't working right, I could buy that they offered her a ride to a service station, but we know the vehicle was still running hours later. So little of this case makes any sense to me. Ultimately, this comes down to two possibilities. Either the men in that minivan were directly involved in Paige's disappearance, or they drove off, leaving her safe, but then someone else showed up and took her. Why she remained there, why she pulled over in the first place, we just don't know. The latter of those options seems a little far-fetched, but stranger things have happened. Unfortunately, without something more or someone recognizing these composites, I don't see where police can really go. It seems unlikely that they have enough to develop touch DNA, or if they do, they haven't gotten a match. Sadly, unless someone comes forward with a new tip, the validity of the map is proven, a match to the prints are made, or new technology helps break the case open, the vanishing of Paige Rankowski will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the vanishing of Paige Rankowski, there are many websites, forums, and newspaper articles discussing her case. If you have any information about the vanishing of Paige Rankowski, please contact the Livingston County Sheriff's Department at 517-546-2440 or the Michigan State Police at 810-227-1149. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, tag me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I've had a couple of people ask me about the availability of Trace Evidence merchandise. There's a couple of places you can go. You can go to traceevidence.threadless.com to see a wide selection of t-shirts and stickers and other items. You can also just go straight to the website trace-evidence.com and click the merch link in the header, which will provide you with links to places where all Trace Evidence merchandise is available. Did you know the True Crime Podcast Festival is taking place in Kansas City, Missouri this year? I'll be there representing Trace Evidence, along with hundreds of other true crime podcasters. If you visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com/trace, you'll receive 10% off your ticket. I had a really amazing time there last year, and I love meeting listeners, so I'd love to see you there this year. Remember, truecrimepodcastfestival.com/trace, or simply use promo code TRACE at checkout. It's time to thank our Patreon producers. Special shout out to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Roberta Jansen, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Bacon Bits the Cat, Pamela Coburn, Abigail, Brett Eady, Kevin Bonham, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Jessica, Laura Dickinson, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Megan Cotter, Quinn McBreen, Randy Weiland, Robbie Blue, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. If you think your name should be on this list, but it's not, please contact me, as Patreon is often terrible at organizing the lists properly. I want to thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.